LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Listen without limits. Unchain your brain. Change your thinking. Change your life. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host, Greg Moffat, and my guests today are Thomas Sheridan and Maria Wheatley. We discuss ancient megalithic sites, their importance throughout human history, their place in the modern era and in the future. At a time of increasing interest in such sites, which many people instinctively intuit as highly significant, there exist increasing controls and restrictions on access to these places of power. Why might this be happening, and who or what might be behind it? Hello and welcome, Thomas, Maria, and thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Good to be here.
So our subject today, as the title indicates, is access to ancient sites, specifically megalithic ones, but others as well, and any kind of agenda or agendas that might be driving that, trying to keep people away from these places, these very ancient places of huge significance, even though much of that is still unknown and may never really be known. But we all intuit, or many of us intuit, that there's something special about these places. And you, both of you, have a lot of experience in this area and a lot to say on the topic. Before we jump into that, maybe you could each just give a brief little bio and state your interest in this topic.
Sure. Well, I'll kick off, so to speak, and thanks for having me, and welcome to you both and all of your listeners here this evening. Really, for me, I'm a second generation dowser. I've been studying megaliths for many years. I've written about 8 books now on various different sites, and I've traveled the world quite extensively and looking at different aspects of megalithic sites as well, from ley lines, earth energies, human consciousness, and interaction with ancient sites.
Thomas.
My background academically was I studied electronic engineering and corporate communications, graphic design. I worked in the corporate world and dropped out of that in the 2000s and been interested in writing books on things like psychopathy to mind control, megaliths to magic, and made films on everything from H.P. Lovecraft to Jack Parsons and everything else in between. And currently not working on anything at the moment, but I am interested. I'm developing a new interest possibly around what we're going to talk about today.
Wonderful. Well, I thought it might be interesting to cast each of our minds back to whenever it was earlier in our lives when megaliths and this period of ancient history kind of came onto our radar and how our interest developed. So if I'll give you an example in my case. Like a lot of little boys, I was fascinated by dinosaurs and by ancient Earth history, because no one seemed to really be able to say very much about it. So I was fascinated by these creatures themselves, because they look like comic book monsters. But then the sheer spans of time that scientists were talking about, that they existed, how impossibly long ago it was, and how vast that seemed compared to human timescales, the way people talk about ancient history, as in, Egypt, Greece, Sumeria, etc. And then when I heard about these megalithic sites being, in some cases older than any of these, and no one knew what they were for. Of course, you had armchair pundits saying, oh, well, they were this, that, and the other thing, but no one really seemed to know. So this would have been when I was, just getting into my teens, and I watched Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World TV show, and there was an accompanying book with an image of Stonehenge in the sunset or sunrise on it. And I just became fascinated mainly by the fact, not only of the structures, which seemed to be unlike anything else, but the fact that no one knew what they were for. But something in me said, these are made by humans who in many ways are just like us, but there's something different here. And I felt there was something in our lack of understanding about their purpose. That meant that we were missing something about ourselves fundamentally. And so since then, it's been not to the depth that you both have done, but it's been an ongoing fascination and interest of trying to learn about these places and visit some of them and actually experience the energy and the wonder of them.
Yes, I think ancient sites call a lot of people. I take hundreds of people around ancient sites, so there is something about them that call to us across time. And I got into visiting sites really from a very young age with my family, actually. We used to go from ancient site to ancient site. And then round about the age of 11, my family moved to Pennsylvania in America, and I started going around the ancient sites of ancient America as well, which is really kind of off the radar. Even Americans that I take around Stonehenge don't know about ancient America. So I've been in it for a lifetime. And over the past 8 years or so, I have studied at institutions like Oxford University and Bath University to really try and get into the archaeological mindset, because I think the more that we come together rather than being drifted apart, so to speak, we can find solutions. And you're right. The one thing that I found fascinating about ancient sites is who built them and why, and what were they used for and when. And so they're the questions that I have been addressing for the past or 20 or 30 years or so. And I've reached some very unorthodox conclusions about that, which hopefully we'll go into later.
Yeah, for me, it was a school trip when I was 10 years old. They took us up to the Boyne Valley to see Newgrange and Douth and Knowth, and they took us to the Hill of Tara. But when I was, well, they took us inside the tumulus, the mound at Newgrange, and the guide was explaining that this building was like, at least 1,000 years, maybe more, older than the pyramids. Now, I never knew these places existed. I didn't even know what they were. I didn't even know about standing stones at that time or anything, and it was instantly a very powerful memory of the kind of magic and the kind of the sublime connected to it. There was almost like an instant romance for me. I couldn't use that language when I was a kid, but that's how it feels now looking back on it. So that's what happened to me, and it just it, again, like you said, like Greg said. An enormous mystery that the academic part of it just wasn't addressing for me. I read any books about or watched TV documentaries on mainstream TV about it. It just seemed wrong, nonsense. And in the last few years, in fact, I am working on a film about megaliths coming up. I've come to the conclusion that a lot of the things they've told us in the mainstream Orthodox archaeology concerning the megaliths on these islands in particular. It's completely wrong.
Yeah, well, there's a number of popular theories, they've been around for a long time, and they persist. I mean, there's some degree of accuracy, probably to one or more of them. And in the same breath that I heard that the Great Pyramids of Giza, for example, and of course there's pyramids all over Egypt, North Africa, all over the world, in fact. But in the same breath, I heard that they were just tombs. And that all the complexities inside them were kind of, well, that's just, I don't know what that is, but they're tombs. We were told about sites like Stonehenge, for example, being astronomical calendars or observatories or calculators, and that there seems to be some sense to that, with all the alignments of very, a lot of these sites, that they were ceremonial sites. Again, that those two things overlap. But later I started to learn about other dimensions of them. That wasn't talked about so much, and this in the work of people like Paul Devereaux, speaking about the energy of these sites, just the general feeling around the stones, but also of the actual properties of the stones themselves. When you looked at quartz content, for example, so there was a whole other world to these things that I think was never, in when I was growing up anyway, not taken seriously in any of the books or programs that I heard or watched, because the implication again was, well, if there was anything to that, that would imply a great deal of like a level of understanding and intelligence and creativity in the ancients, which clearly they didn't have. They could build stuff, but they how could they possibly understand what modern science is even now struggling to grapple with?
Yes, I think the opposite, actually. I think, the ancients were very advanced. And today, when we build a building, for example, a new build, you have an architect and they will go in and they will design it and they will say it's for this, it's for that. In the ancient world, you had a huge amount of disciplines involved. You had astronomers, you had geomancers, you had mathematicians, and I believe musicians as well. Because when we look at places like Stonehenge, you mentioned the calendar aspect of it, which is very well mooted. It has numerous solar and lunar aspects, and I went on to discover some celestial aspects about Stonehenge. But its acoustic properties, you touched on Paul Devereux. I was talking to Paul Devereux about 3 or 4 months ago, actually, because he shares an interest in my work and I in his. So I think there's all of these aspects involved in ancient site. They're not just one thing. They're a multifaceted diamond that can be used by different people. By different people, I mean there was people coming from all over the world to places like Stonehenge as artifacts in the landscape attest. But I think one of its fundamental principles is its acoustic power and properties.
I would agree with both of you, absolutely, in every way. And this just goes to show what Maria just said. You can add so many layers onto this multi-phase element of them over tremendous periods of time. But the one in recent years that I've really started to question is this notion that the megaliths, particularly on these islands and in France and so on, were a result of the spread of agriculture from the east that started out in the Fertile Crescent and made its way over here. Now, this is under the assumption that these people couldn't build these things unless they had a regular supply of food, and that could only have been procured through tillage and agricultural and harvesting and so on. The fact is that if you lived on the coast of these islands, you had so much food from the sea in terms of everything from shellfish, and lots of these things are built near the coast or they're on islands like Orkney and stuff like that. Nourishment and nutrition was everywhere. Why would you bother going to all the stress and effort to plant crops on a vast scale? See, this is what they told us in school, and still, you're still being told this. It was basically a debt cult that revolved around agriculture and fertility. And I've now come to see, okay, might have been an element of that, but these people were, the food that they have found have been things like hazelnuts and fish bones. These people were, the rivers of Ireland would have had colossal salmon back then. The woods would have been full of everything to eat, and all year round you could eat at the coast. There was no problem there. So, and they would have had to have very good nutrition to build their neural pathways in order to construct these things and think about them, particularly the artwork on the sophisticated artwork on the rocks themselves. And that's all that remains. We don't know what was ever painted or what kind of clothes or anything they were capable textiles they may have developed. So, again, I was raised thinking it was a fertility cult that worshipped debt and rebirth through the sun. Yeah, maybe that's true. That could have been an element of it. But that to me was, if you read the old antiquarian books, they used things like barbarous and rude stones. This whole thing that these were kind of like uncivilized, sort of like immoral people. That's often applied to anyone before, like basically 2,000 years ago. And I'm finding that quite the opposite now. I think you could literally draw a blank slate on the megaliths, particularly on these islands, tomorrow, and begin again, because we've been following an academic and also a popular trajectory, particularly out of the 60s hippies movement that would like to imagine the place was full of naked girls running around, being impregnated and dancing and banging drums and all this. We start again from blank, and I've been trying to do that lately. And say, look, if I knew nothing about this, what would I think they were? And the last thing I come to is the sort of orthodoxy that we've been handed to us surrounding them.
Oh, yeah. Just to be clear, by the way, Maria, I wasn't saying by any means that I thought what I was getting from mainstream media and
No.
text about
Oh,
our the
not at
ancients,
all.
but just that's what, if you accepted it, swallowed it whole,
No.
that's what you could think. Well, as
No.
far as you mentioned nuts and fish, Thomas, I mean, look at the current, it is a fad to some extent, but there's something to, the paleo diet that's much talked about today, and you look at the collective brain fog caused by ultra processed foods and the sort of the diet that we've well, actually you could argue that humans have followed since the mass adoption of agriculture, you know, basically grains and wheat, plant vegetables are grown below the ground. It seems that those above the ground, like leafy greens and berries, etc., are much less, or much better for us, and or much less damaging, depending on the degree of processing. And you talking about agriculture, there is also a theory talking about the energy of these sites that John Michael Greer has a couple of books, basically a sort of a pair of books that go together that speak about it's a legend of the Holy Grail, and talking about a misunderstanding of what that might have been, and the possibility that some of these sites were like energy accumulators, you know, to draw energy together, and that the loss of the Holy Grail and the land being wasted was actually some kind of mass crop failure. You know, once people have become reliant on crops, if that fails, then you know you're in a world of hurt, and that there might have been something to that. So just that's one possible interpretation of the Grail legend.
I live in a place called Sligo that translates as a place of shells in Irish. And the reason for that is there are millions, perhaps billions, of oyster, mussel, and other shells from seafood, shellfish, and middens all along the coast. And right next to them are megaliths. So these people were able to procure high levels of nutrition. The evidence is there in these millions upon millions of shells that were from the Neolithic. So they were able to eat well, build megaliths, and then develop a culture. Agriculture, I don't think, brought the megaliths to these islands, but I think they ended the megalithic culture, or except damaged it. And it may have been what you said, famine started to kick in, and there wasn't enough nutrition basically to continue. Basically, what was that? Whatever they were up to.
Yes, I mean, when we look to climate change that happened in prehistoric times, for example, there was a kind of golden time in the Neolithic and the early and the late Bronze Age. And you can tell that by sample cores, for example, towards the end of the late Bronze Age, for instance, that's when we had a really bad climate change and it was sudden. The temperature dropped by a degree, really, really suddenly. So places like Avebury and Stonehenge, they became kind of wet and soggy. It went from a subboreal climate to the skies that we have today, raining and quite cold. So the culture changed then, but preceding that, there was certainly a really advanced culture that used mathematics, especially at places like Stonehenge and Avebury, the huge megalithic Neolithic sites. And then I questioned, for example, 10 years ago, who built these ancient sites in the Neolithic period? Because that's when you had the giant henges, especially in the south of England and even places like Orkney. And it came to me that the people may not have looked like us. So I really went into the archaeological record after looking into particular sites around Stonehenge and realized that the history had been suppressed and that some of the ancient peoples in the Neolithic had very long skulls, for example. And I went to various universities and museums to photograph this long lost culture and to find out more about them. So I don't even think sometimes the historians, the archaeologists, and the anthropologists have got it 100% right. And this is where people like I come in and the listeners and Thomas comes in, because we question the answers that we have about these ancient sites. And believe me, if you dig a little bit deeper, if you scratch beneath the surface, you will find that we have been spoon-fed a narrative that is incorrect and quite deceptive, actually, into the glory of our ancient past.
If you look at Mediterranean world, how in the classical period, how much more developed in terms of arts, sciences, and philosophies that came out of that compared to Northern Europe, it ties in perfectly with what Maria was saying, because in Northern Europe you couldn't develop philosophy while they're trying to avoid hypothermia. It's a different, you don't have the time, you're trying to stay alive. And I think that's, you could apply that, yeah, you would apply that to the, when she was saying there was a more salubrious climate in these islands,
Definitely.
and people had more time to develop art, science, magic, philosophies, religions. And then when the climate change happened and plunged it into the what we have now, it became just a matter of more of a matter of survival. So climate is very important in all these things. So that's you're looking at like the I think we used to always joke, Maria, but going back years about was it 2500 BC? Well, that was that's the date that's the kind of arbitrary date they've picked for everything, because the rationale behind that is that's when the Sahara Desert became desiccated, and then that they claim that that's where all the megaliths and all the other changes and all happened around that period. But to be honest, I think the megaliths are actually probably much older now. I think some of them could be spectacularly older, and as particularly the ones in the south of England, they show elements, and the ones up in Orkney too, they show elements of weathering that seems that underneath that weathering they were more they were it was more like dressed stone. They were cut better, and what we're looking at is much, much longer periods. I think I might be wrong, only in some of them. I'm not saying all of them, of erosion. Of much more severe erosion over descent over a longer period than we're told.
Well, there's that graphic, Thomas, that you'll probably know straight away where I'm going with this. The three panel graphic that I first saw on social media, you posted it there. I looked up the artist who'd done some similar things, and I've only ever done two presentations in my life. Both involve megaliths, and I used that graphic in both of them. And it shows a kind of a current state of affairs where we are. It's a fictionalized megalithic site, and then there the middle panel is the Ice Age. Not much going on. Things, everyone's struggling to survive. A lot of people and a lot of animals, a lot of life in general doesn't. But then there's the pre-Ice Age panel showing this. It kind of encapsulates the idea of Graham Hancock style, advanced civilizations pre-Ice Age, and just talking about the age of these sites, as you were, Thomas. That's one of the reasons I got so fascinated, as I said earlier, with the dinosaurs, and then also with prehistory in human terms, is what can we really say about what happened before the Ice Age? So I agree with you. I mean, I work every day in a medieval building that the current version of which was constructed over 252 years, and there's evidence of the previous buildings and some of the erosion there that may be 700, 800 years worth of gentle erosion, almost all the details gone. Not even 1,000 years.
And now imagine that being in somewhere like Orkney, where you have the winds from the North Atlantic and the rain bashing it constantly. I'll give you a very practical example. It might tie in with what we're going to talk about, the main subject of this video. Jack Roberts, who was passed away now, is a good friend of mine and kind of like a famous megalithic guy here. He had told me that when the Office of Public Works had like taken some of the old sods off the top of one of the structures on the top of Loch Crew on the east coast of Ireland, he said that the concentric circles and the other rock artwork were really sharp. They were sharp, and they were exposed to the elements in the 1980s. And he said by the 2000s, you couldn't see them. So are you telling me that these things, that what was that 30, 40 years? And he said it was noticeable to his eye. That that some of the rock art had actually been deteriorated. Now, are you telling me now that that these things have lasted all these years? They haven't. They've la The only reason we have the rock art on Newgrange is because the stones were buried upside down with the artwork facing downwards away from the elements. So, yeah, I mean, I think how these things have survived the erosion, they shouldn't even be standing. Like the stones of Stegness and in Orkney, that they're quite thin and they're really long. Were they once wider and more straight? There's just endless numbers of questions.
Yeah, well, I think you look at other stone structures around the world of various, antiquity, and it seems to be, I'm generalizing a great deal now, but it seems that a lot of human cultures have some try to, if they're building in stone or whatever, that to sort of emulate nature, things to fit in with nature, and sometimes to contrast, so humans will often do machine-like things, blocks and rectangles and shapes that you don't see in nature because for whatever reason they're pleasing. You think of classical and then neoclassical architecture. Some of it is reminiscent of natural forms, and some of it is quite unlike anything you see in nature. But maybe, our interpretation of it's still very beautiful with like curves, but not anything that is seen in nature as such, or not. I'm no biologist, but not that I'm aware of. So it makes more sense to me that if stone, whatever type it happens to be, from something soft like limestone or sandstone through to granite, undergoes weathering over time, which everything does, then the forms that we see today, even if they still resemble the originals and weren't squared off, they weren't rectangular blocks or cubes or whatever, that there was more material there than there is now. So what we're seeing today isn't like, you can't just superimpose some Neolithic humans onto that scene and say, here's what we'd have been looking at.
Yeah, I think there's evidence as well to put the timeline back. I was invited at the beginning of October to attend an archaeological dig to look for some artifacts in the Stonehenge area. Unfortunately, I'd hurt my arm and I didn't want to stand up for hours on end in water looking for washing up, looking for artifacts. But I was invited along, and they have found artifacts going back to 12,000 BC around Stonehenge. So the timeline is going back. But what's the evidence for this as well? In the Avebury landscape in which I live, there's a huge mound called Silbury Hill, and some of your listeners will be very familiar with that. It's the largest man-made mound in Europe, standing majestically 130 feet high. It was opened up about 15 or so years ago now by some archaeologists, Jim Leary and David Fields. They call themselves the mound experts. And they went through an old pre-existing tunnel that had been dug in the 1960s. So they're re-entering Silbury Hill. My colleague, John Cowie, the late John Cowie, he was also invited in, and the archaeologist took a carbon sample. That's problematic in itself, but it is the Holy Grail. Carbon, you can date it, even if it has its problematic emblem about it. Nonetheless, my colleague took a sample, and so did the Jim Leary team. My colleagues, John Cowie's, came up with 12,000 BC. Their sample came up with 2460 BC and the latter date. Now, theoretically, we could say then that Silbury Hill is one of the oldest monuments in the world, on par with discussed relatively recently found in Turkey, like Göbekli Tepe and others besides. So I think the timeline is being put back, and it's exciting that we live amid these times.
It in Karamor in Sligo, about 30 years ago, a Swedish team got a perfect sample of soil that was trapped between inside a mound again. I think it's Cairn 41. One of the capstone of the internal, what they call a domo, but the internal chamber of the mound. The capstone was resting on top of the orstat, and it was almost like a sealed chamber of a bit of some soil inside it. So it was a perfect sample. You couldn't get a better sample for carbon dating because bunny rabbits had never been near it, worms had never been near it. It was completely not disturbed. It had been there since the capstone was laid on top. They might have actually even used the soil as some kind of a thing to stop it hitting it hard. So the Swedish team got 12,500 BC, exact same date you're saying, Ms. Maria. It was all over the papers. It was a big deal. We have the oldest sites in the world here in this part of Ireland. The Irish archaeologists came along and said, go back and do it again, and this time get the right date. And it was, back 5,000, it was the 5,000 date again.
Exactly, and that's what I think we're kind of we're moving together as a movement. I think, a lot of authors these days, we've created some kind of movement, and that's what I find exciting as well, to look at these dates, to look at these places, and the archaeologists will eventually catch up with us, and say, yes, these dates have been proved correct. And when you look at a site like Stonehenge, and some of the stones seem an odd shape and even a bit kind of crooked, so to speak. Up until the 19th century, you could buy a hammer from the nearby town of Amesbury and chip a little bit off and go home with it. It's been calculated that tonnage have gone from Stonehenge. And why were people doing that? And why were they permitted to do that? Ever since the 12th century, with a book written by Geoffrey of Monmouth, The History of the Kings of Britain, he said, no stone at Stonehenge doth not have healing power. So when we're looking at these ancient sites, and we know that they were believed to be healing sites, some of them, acoustic sites, another, people with hammers smashing into them. For example, it's now believed that Stonehenge was a perfect rectangular monument, a bit like how Indigo Jones drew it in 1666. So my point here is, do we even glimpse at the truth of an ancient site? We have to really go there with open eyes and think what came before rather than what we're looking at today.
So that's could lead us down a fascinating avenue. Do we want to, either of you or both of you want to pursue that, or should we move to kind of the main topic?
Absolutely.
Okay, so you mentioned Geoffrey of Monmouth there, and even I read him in school. I didn't remember that detail actually. But so over since these sites were active, let's just say, if we can put it that way, maybe in their original form, obviously in the centuries after their construction, who knows what changed. And you said earlier, Maria, of course, they had multiple uses, a bit like an arena today. You can have all sorts of events inside an arena. It doesn't have to be just one thing. It's built in a certain way, but it's got multiple functions, and each of those functions can serve different and many purposes. But so there's been use and disuse and interest in and disinterest in the city sites, I think, over the centuries and millennia. It's come and gone, but they've always had some kind of fascination for humans. It's interesting to me that as we've fast forward to the first quarter of the 21st century, can't believe that's coming to an end already, that where we find ourselves talking about these sites, that simultaneously you can find and hear voices saying, yeah, they might be interesting, but they're of no significance. A pile of old rocks, built by primitives. We got fences around them because, it's history. We like history. It's culture, blah, blah, blah. But again, no other real significance or no real meaning or purpose, and nothing we can say anything about. But at the same time, this tremendous and increasing kind of, not just regarding these sites, but all sorts of, metaphysical and esoteric matters is kind of like, no, if you're talking about this in these ways about places of power and energy and meaning, stop that. Don't do that. You're not allowed to be, it used to be portrayed as a harmless crank if you had these ideas, but now it's like actually trying to shut people down. I mentioned Graham Hancock earlier, just because he's very high profile or relatively high profile, people like him and the abuse that they get from the archaeology mainstream. So it's like, yeah, these sites have got no significance, no meaning. Oh, but by the way, if you're talking about that, trying to steer people away, trying to divert the increasing interest that even I find amongst people that I know who exhibited no prior interest in such places and such topics, seems to be something that people in general are being drawn to. And perhaps that speaks to our times, really. We're being challenged on so many fronts. And fundamentalist materialism is still the reigning paradigm, and then we move ever into transhumanist and technocratic changes happening in the world. And so people seem to be instinctively wanting to reground themselves and reconnect with something that is actually even more so than the stones, eternal.
Yeah, I'm glad Maria brought up Geoffrey of Monmouth because that also shows that the folklore is has tremendous tenacity with these places. That the folklore is also, that's what I've been called an alternative folklorist in recent years. And I suppose that's what I am. But because I'm actually looking at the folklore very deeply. Yes, it's allegory, but there's also, one of the Geoffrey of Monmouth's stories was that the stones at Stonehenge had been levitated from Ireland and brought across to where they are today. Now we all know that they come from these mountains, the mountain range in Wales. But then someone pointed out that at the time when Merlin was supposed to exist, in the fourth or fifth century, the end of the Roman era, and that was actually part of Ireland that had been conquered, and was actually, that's why there's Ulm stones and all kinds of other Celtic crosses and stuff in that part of Wales. So it was telling the truth. It was a part of Ireland at that time. Now, obviously, he didn't levitate them down because we know they're much older, but that the folklore, the allegories change. It was a way he was saying that magic was involved in this, just like the healing stones. There's magic, and we know the scientific reasons for magic and so on like that. But they always have this magic idea of magic connected to them, whether it's for healing, whether it's for anything. And the folklore is very revealing. Like the first antiquarian to write about Newgrange was a Welsh one called Lund. I think it was about 1699. He interviewed a local farmer, and the farmer told him about, and he writes, some barbarous ritual involving the sun. Now, that was the solstice, and it had lasted in the local community for centuries, maybe thousands of years, in their folklore. And if there's one area of the megaliths that's and the ancient sites that's really neglected, is a serious study of the folklore, because people don't take it seriously. They think, oh, it's all recent, it's all rustic. Like, how could it be? How could a megalith in an Anglo-Saxon area of England reflect history from thousands of years ago? No, they would have picked it up and passed it on. And that's a real, pearl in the oyster that is yet to be fully extracted from all this. That, again, because it's not taken seriously. Now, we know that there was about 15 years ago, there was a study done by the University of Durham and the University of Lisbon in Portugal, and they showed that folk tales are spectacularly ancient. Yes, they used basically a genetic mapping technique to find various memes and stuff inside fairy tales, and have to map them right back, literally thousands and thousands of years. So folklore is also, a very important thing, and invariably, what does the folklore regarding megaliths, particularly on these islands, in cases represent? Magic and healing. You see that same theme come up over and over again.
Yes, I mean, there's one folklore about Stanton Drew Stone Circle in Somerset, which is the second largest stone circle in the world, second only to Avebury Henge, for example. And the folklore there is that on the sixth day after a new moon, the stones get up and walk down for a drink in the River Chew. Well, obviously, their stones aren't going to move and they're going to go down for a drink in the River Chew. But as a water diviner and an earth energy expert, I do know that underground water, especially a large volume, a bit like a lake or an aquifer, for example, it becomes more active 6 days after a new or full moon. And that has been widely documented, for example, and Pliny the Elder, he went on to say that the Druids, of the Iron Age, for example, only picked certain herbs like mistletoe 6 days after the new moon. And that is bringing us into the synchronicity, into entrainment in what's happening below the ground with deep waters, for example. So I agree, there is so much to folklore that if we dive a little bit deeper, like I said earlier, scratch the surface a little bit more, you come up with ancient truths.
So, currently, I looked into it. I've obviously heard about access to megalithic sites. I mean, we know they're never restricted. You visit a few, you find out different conditions when you get there. Some of them you can just walk up to. Castlerigg, in the Lake District, it's one of the most impressive sites, possibly the most spectacular physical or geographical location. For a stone circle that I've ever seen, anyway. I visited there a few years ago after a heavy snowfall, and there was just two of us there, no one else there at all. And even just scanning the mountain range around there, I was just blown away just by the atmosphere and the energy of the place. Others, maybe a single stone, a little cluster on the ground in the farmer's field, you can just walk up to. Somewhere like Stonehenge, by contrast, obviously so popular because of its fame and its notoriety, You have a visitor center, a car park, tickets, gift shop, cafe, probably. I've not been there. All of that stuff, and it's highly commercialized and seems very far removed from its original way of being and its atmosphere and anything to do with meaning or purpose behind its construction. And then you have a lot of these sites, thousands, and that's it, they're on private land and mostly cannot be accessed by individuals, maybe with permission. But I remember being into starting to get into rock music in the early 80s, and one of the first things, listening to the music of a band called Hawkwind, I know Thomas is very familiar with, was hearing about their Stonehenge concerts and seeing some of the footage and the photographs around that, and people sitting on top of the triptychs and band playing next to it and everything else. And then all of the police intervention around that time, which we've all lived long enough to remember. So that was the first time that I experienced, well, why would anybody have a problem with people being around these places? Maybe I was a little bit young and naive, because obviously lots of public attention, people trample around, they leave their litter, they damage the stones. You mentioned chipping bits off. There's a where does vandalism begin, and kind of wanting part of that for yourself, in a positive sense, where does that end? So it was my first awareness that there was some kind of controversy around these sites involving the authorities. Prior to that, I was thinking, what would anybody other than, English Heritage or whatever other organizations might be involved here have to do with it? So maybe we could say something about, your experience of that, both of you, and maybe how you've seen that develop, and maybe something about why we're actually having this conversation now, because things continue to move. And not always in a very good direction.
Yes, I think with places like Stonehenge and Newgrange, to some regard, they have always been UK to enter the anniversary of the Battle of the Beanfield at Stonehenge, when the police were called in and they were exceptionally heavy-handed. So it's the 40th year this year, and I remember those times of the 80s. But our rights are being encroached upon. For example, Avebury Henge, it's a free site. You can go there by day or by night, a bit like at Castle Rigg, Swinside, and many other places besides. But slowly creeping in will be an enforcement of you will be paying. The first thing they're doing at Avebury is saying to people that go there in a group, whether you're a professional tour guide or whether you're with a group, you're supposed to have a permit now. And that's the first phase. Let's get one group and get them to pay, and then later we'll get everybody to pay. And it's like I said, when Alexander Keeler, he excavated the place in the 1930s, restored it, he gave it to the British people. And then in come these institutions like the National Trust and English Heritage. So I think our rights at ancient sites are being slowly, slowly eroded, other than places like Stonehenge. And then at a site like Glastonbury, and I'm sure Thomas will be able to jump in on that, that's going to be one. It's wanting to be a UNESCO World Heritage Site. And with that, you'll get buses. And with that, you'll get your QR code. And like a Muppet, you'll be putting your mobile phone over that and listening to their narrative. Thomas and I, about 10 or 11 years ago now, went to the Hypogeum in Malta. It's one of the most spectacular sites in the world, and we could walk around there. Now, you go to the Hypogeum, you are literally enforced to listen to the headphone. And when I didn't want to listen to the headphone at Malta, because I was leading my own group, I got told several times, listen to the narrative. So I think slowly creeping in at places like the Hypogeum and Avebury, our rights to be at these sites, to feel the energies, to touch the stones, to touch time past, is being slowly, and in some cases speedily, at pace, being eroded.
There is an agenda that seems to be happening very quickly. It's been going on for a long time. Well, not, like I said, when I first visited, Newgrange as a little boy, the bus could pull up on the road behind it, and there was no interpretive center or anything. You just went to the hill. And nowadays you go into an interpretive center and a bus takes you on this unbelievably long journey across the River Boyne and over to the site. It seems totally unnecessary, but it feels like you're entering into like Eastern Europe or something. The holy island on the Shannon in back in the communist days, I should add. They've actually got more freedom than we have now. Back in the communist day, back in the on Holy Island on the Shannon, which has a megalith enclosed inside a Romanesque church, which is it was built in the Middle Ages, and there's one round tower and lots of other interesting megalithic structures. They recently got their UNESCO World Heritage status, and they got a big boat. So it was on like a cruiser to take the busloads of tourists over after they paid for their ticket on the mainland, and it takes them over the river to the island, and they get that, the headphone thing now. And that used to be just a lovely place to visit. If you could, if you were young enough and strong enough, you could swim over in the old days, if the weather was good, you could get a boat off a local farmer or fisherman, and that's all gone now. It's locked down. And Carrickmore is applying for a UNESCO heritage status here in Sligo, and it also brings a lot of money in because all kinds of grants are available for things like buying, like the fancy cruise boat for Holy Island and the Shannon and other things like that. But there's a rush now; it's happening on micro levels. Farmers are restricting access now, because they're worried about insurance. Somebody falls and hurts themselves. There's a really weird thing happened in Ireland last two couple of years where there was high profile stories of vandalism to the rock art at both Loch Crewe and at Carrowkeel. And in both cases, it wasn't vandalism, it was chalk or something. It wasn't anything like they smashed the stones up or wrecked the rock art or anything. And the media went into wild hysteria, and there's all people talking about we have to protect these sites. And the latest one is, and you won't believe this one, speaking of underground caves, Maria, Owen Ni Gap, the cave of the Morrigan, they put a cage now at the entrance. You're allowed to go into the first part, and then there's a gate apparently there now. And the reason for it is, they claim, is the carbon dioxide levels in the bottom of the cave are dangerous. So even that's been like fenced off now. And this has all been happening very quickly. And I'm hearing all around the country, people are telling me there used to be no gate on this thing. Now there's a gate. You have to go get a key from somebody. You have to get permission. And it seems incredibly sinister to me. And I know it's going to sound like woo, but I think they're not just stopping it to kill our heritage, because they want that too. Who controls the past controls the future. So kill off our heritage. That's definitely an agenda. There's no doubt about that. But there's something, there's something else they're afraid of, and I'm more inclined to go along the way of woo. Why are so many of us attracted to these sites since the late 70s, early 80s? It all happened around then. All the great work of like the new generations that came, like John Michel in England, and Martin Brennan here in Ireland, and Lar Dooley, who passed away recently, Jack Robinson, all the old guard are all dying now, and they all started in the late 70s, early 80s, which is around the same time a lot of sort of things like Quaker Mass and all this popular, the Children of the Stones, started to build this mystique around the stones. And a part of me now wonders, was some kind of energetic force has been waking up since then, attracting a certain kind of people to these sites, and is it now peaking? And do the powers that be know this? I know it sounds out there, but I'm ready. I need an answer, and I can't get a sensible one.
Thomas, you remember that thing I did at Neil's conference, Megaliths in the Movies, charting appearances of megalithic sites and the energies around them in TV and film, and almost all of them, well, all of them for either from the late 60s, the 70s, and a couple from the early 80s, all from that time period.
Recently, I've done a lot of tests at Avebury without permission. I add to that for film that's coming out, because where I douse a certain particular energy emitted from a standing stone, so I'm talking megalithic energy, not earth energy, I knew that it was changing my consciousness. So I got a neuroscientist from Exeter Hospital who has what's called the mind mirror. And the mind mirror can register in my left brain to my right brain. And if I enter an energy field and it does exist, then it will register on this equipment. And that's what I did. I doused it first of all and then walked into the energy zone. And instantly, literally instantly, my brain entered Delta, which should only be in very, very deep sleep, very, very deep meditation, for example. And as I headed towards another earth energy this time, it came out at 10 hertz, and it was entraining my brain to match the earth frequencies. And I believe those earth frequencies are being absorbed by the standing stones and being emitted by the standing stones. And we did some tests on those as well. And if you touch that particular area where I claimed that there was an energy and an energetic force coming out, the brain registered it. So there's a science behind this, and it's an esoteric science. And for those that listen and join me and others beside and say, how can we prove that? Well, you can. And it is happening. And when people go to Avebury and the center of Stonehenge and Carrickeel and Carra Moor, and sadly, Owy na Gadd, I found that one of the most profound experiences in Ireland. And I'm really saddened to hear that, Thomas. It does something to us. It brings out a higher consciousness. And that's the magic behind the stones.
Do you remember years ago we were in West Kennet and I took out a tone generator inside one of the antechambers in the passageway and it went woo, it went absolutely nuts. It's like it shouldn't do that. It's a fixed tone. It should have done that. And that to this day, that has always blown my mind because there was something in that chamber that affected the electronics in the device. So if it's affecting that, it's affecting our nervous system, our central nervous systems.
Absolutely.
And some of us are more sensitive to it than others. But I think as the years are progressing, we probably got in there early, whatever, what kind of weirdos we were as kids, but we probably got in there early. But it seems to be happening a lot of people now. And that's just the whole thing. Is it the are the sites waking up and are they trying to restrict access for that reason?
Well, that's interesting what Thomas said, because I can remember in 2010, I was leading a tour for a conference in the south of England, and there were some big people attending. So, I'm bigging it up and saying, when you touch the stones, I believe that you can have inspiration, call it a download, call it what you will. When you interact with the stones at Stonehenge, that's where we were, you do feel something. And I've got many an inspiration from that. And myself and others felt that the earth energies were rising and accumulating. Yep, kind of coming up a frequency, for want of a better explanation, just to get that idea out there. And so I was bigging it up, and in that year, just as the energies, we believe, from my point of view, were rising, that's when they first introduced you can't touch the stones at Stonehenge. And as a kind of dowser and a person working with these different types of energy, I knew that was exceeding. So I think the people do know that, and they do know that you can get a lot of people into somewhere like Avebury Henge. 2,000 people, it's being calculated, can fit into that Henge monument. And could you imagine if you got 2,000 people there and suddenly they get switched on to a different higher consciousness? Ooh, well, we can't have that now, can we?
I got some news recently from, I'm not going to name the place here in Ireland because one of the people who works there has been a good friend to me over the years and kept me out of trouble with archaeologists and stuff like that. But they built a new center onto it, a new visitor center. And apparently everyone in the building feels sick. Everybody feels weird all the time. And there has been an explosion of rats. And they've even had Zoom calls where they've been contacting people try and get something to do with the rats, and the rats are running around in the background. And this is not anywhere near a farm or a food processing plant. There's nowhere for that. There's nothing for these numbers of rats to eat around there. So they built this new interpretive center, or whatever it was, visitor center, on this land adjacent to it. And apparently, all kinds of weird energetic stuff, as well as an invasion of rats, has happened. And none of the staff are happy. The staff, they're complaining about illness constantly. And I was told off record that they think that they, this person is an academic, and said, "Yeah, I'm starting to think that we interrupted, we meddled with some forces we shouldn't have meddled with."
Well, if you look up online now, just what you were saying, Maria, about, if you want to look at things through the lens of science, that's just one way of doing things. But if people would like to do that, then there is something there to see. Even if you look up stone tape theory online now, you can find all sorts of quite dry, musings from often from scientists just saying about thinking about how there could be something to that, so it's not just immediately dismissed as kind of like what are you talking about, how could these sites possibly have any energetic properties? And I do wonder, Thomas was referencing, that sort of thing, that movement, that change that seemed to be begin to occur in the 70s, that we all experienced, about some kind of rising energy. That could that possibly be in response to the increasing, electromagnetic soup and EMF bath that's around us all the time, and it's never been more so now, cutting us off from earth energies and natural forces. And is one rising in response to the other? Because that's something that's spoken about often now, about our about especially young people's having no experience of being in a world not free from that, because it's been a century or more since we, really haven't had those forces in the atmosphere all around us. But just being born into a world that with almost like a negative force field around them, an artificial of artificial creation, that's cutting them off from, well, all sorts of things, energetic, but emotional and spiritual as well, that everything non-material essentially.
Well, yes. I do. I don't think. I think some people are cut off, and I expect now people are watching EastEnders, for example, and they're cut off into their soap life. But I do think that the earth energies at sacred sites over the last 10 years have been rising. We've been measuring the frequencies of those, especially megalithic energy. Yeah, that's more even more powerful than the earth energy. And this is why I'm different to Paul Devereaux and different to the other tests, because I will say specifically we go here because that's where the energy field is through through dowsing and through other means. So I think it's about encouraging people to interact. And what I'm finding with young people at the moment, they do want to interact with these ancient sites, and the young archaeologists do want to find Atlantis and Lemuria and become really famous besides for finding it. So they're listening to people like Graham Hancock and myself and thinking, well, what if we found that? So I really think there's a lot of hope for the future as well.
Yeah, everything's on the table. There's almost like a cosmology connected to it as well. I mean, we live in very strange times where these objects are coming into the solar system and they're outgassing towards the sun, not away from it, and where there's all kinds of speculation about them. But it's like this increasingly Nigel Neale Doctor Who episode we've been living in, especially since 2020, really seems to have begun in the late 70s and has been continuing. And it's almost like the fantastical, what was the, you even think, look at things like in the, you'll appreciate this particularly, Greg, the planet people in the Equator Mass 4 going around the sites to be harvested by an alien force. And now you have like Extinction Rebellion and all these other groups looking very similar, behaving in all sort of ritualistic way. And there's more, it's just got very, it's, everything has become very peculiar in, say, the last decade, especially, I've found. And the It's almost like we are living in a kind of a Twilight Zone episode or something, or a Nigel Neale movie or Lovecraft book or something. And I think I find, not, I wouldn't say rationalizations, but almost like a sense of comfort in approaching the megaliths now with a sort of a supernaturalism that I probably wouldn't have done when we first met, like, years ago, Maria. I'm much more into the high strangeness of it all, because it seems to me the one that stuck the most, along with things like your aqua theory. I totally agree. They were different looking people, probably different people in probably lots of ways. And but it's just so weird that I've always sort of like tried not to be Mr. Supernaturalism too much regarding these science sites, and now that's basically what I am. That's basically where I found myself in, and I don't think I'll be moving out of it.
Maria, I would love you to do what you talked about at the top of the hour, which is speak about your more controversial theories around all this. Just before we do that, you talked about Extinction Rebellion, and and the Nigel Neale, the Quatermass Four, and the Planet People. When there was that incident not that long ago with the vandalism at Stonehenge, with that orange, whatever that orange shit was that they threw over the stones, A, I was
Yes, that
reminded.
was the first thing I thought of.
Yeah, exactly. Me too. I was just going, oh my God. And then the other thing I thought of was like this whole thing of like problem reaction solution, oh, vandalizing the stones, so we need to protect them more. You need to keep people away from them because they can't be trusted.
Yes, well, I think the Ministry of Works, long before English Heritage and the National Trust were birthed into being, the Ministry of Works did a lot of damage at Stonehenge, for example. I inherited through my late father the unpublished surveys of numerous master dowsers and the notes of a curator at Stonehenge for more than 25 years. And he was beloved and well respected, and he was on the digs with Richard Atkinson and Professor Stuart Pigott, for example, and he had a notebook with him, basically, and I've got that notebook in short. Now, he was saying, for example, on the outer side of Trilithon stone number 51, for the geeks out there that want to go and look at that stone, on that particular stone there was a hole that went 2 foot down into that stone, where you could literally put your arm into like that. And he said that even in the drought, and even in hot periods, droughts, for example, that hole somehow supernaturally, mysteriously, magically filled up with water. And that water became quite well known to have healing properties for eczema, for asthma, and different things besides. And people got heard about this, and they'd be attracted to this stone. And like I said, this is the custodian, curator of Stonehenge saying this, not somebody that should not be listened to. And what did the Ministry of Works do? Instead of, making that a beautiful point for humanity to go to, they plugged it up with plastic and concrete that you can still see to that day. I photographed that stone, videoed that stone, and you can even see the water runoff, for example, that goes down the stone. Water leaves behind a mark if it's been over, millennia. So I think that's one controversial theory about Stonehenge that's in the written record. And I take people there that are sensitive. I believe I'm sensitive to certain particular forces, and we can still feel the energy field there. So there's that side of it. They have destroyed the stones as much as people throwing orange paint at them, for instance.
I was particularly interested in what you said about the actual human beings looking unlike, for example, the three of us, more or less the same. Obviously, there's been different human species over time, different races, ethnicities, interbreeding, all sorts, and then going further back with different, what's the word I'm looking for? Humanoids, not the right word. The word escapes me. But again, back into prehistory, and we don't really know. We don't know actually what human origins are. But the idea that For example, what you talked about the elongate, slightly elongated skulls.
Quite elongated.
Yeah. So, what? Where did you first encounter that? You know, where can people read about that? Where can they see evidence? What? Why, for example, is that new to me? Besides from being just not enough widely enough read on the subject.
It was about 10 years ago I started to investigate the Neolithic and the long barrens, the long mounds at Stonehenge. They're very different to like West Kennet, and they're not cairns. They're a particular type of long barren. And I got very interested into one particular one because it was the largest in Northwest Europe. I thought, well, that's a good place to start. It's the largest long barren. And because it was so huge, 390 feet long, whereas West Kennet and others 350, 360 feet, it really does dwarf them. I thought it must have housed hundreds of people that were associated with Stonehenge in some shape or form. But it wasn't. It was just for one person. That's very unprecedented. Normally, Neolithic long mounds were for communal burials. Yeah. So this was unprecedented. So I thought, I've got to find out who this person was. And it turned out that it was a woman. And I decided I wanted to go and photograph her. I felt compelled to see this ancient ancestors. The feeling was very, very, very strong. And I did get permission to go to Cambridge University and do some study and do some photography of it. And I realized instantly she was very long skulled, for example. And then I looked into other long mounds around Stonehenge. I believe they housed the magicians and the shamans, for example. And they again had one burial in them. Very different to Avebury, for example. Then I looked into their body shape. I started off with a skull. Yeah, then there was lockdown and all of that shenanigans. And then I started to look in the femur bones. How tall were they? What were their features like? And read some extensive reports from anthropologists, early anthropologists that had looked into them. And their eardrums, the inside of their ears, they constantly were writing that they were different to ours, which I presented to a doctor who came to me with Egypt, to Egypt. And I said to her, what would this, how would this influence a person? And she said, that's incorrect. It can't be like that. And I said, well, what if it is right? I copy cut paste it perfectly. And she said, they could have even heard differently. So maybe they were hearing far differently, maybe ranges that we can't hear. And we do know from Paul Devereux of the Dragon Project, for instance, that the Rollright stones emit ultrasound. I've recorded infrasound on the inside of Rollright. So I think these ancient people look differently. Their ear placement was slightly different as well, which I believe contributed to some myths of the Fae, for example, that descended into the mounds, for example. So they would have looked different. Their skulls, even though they were very long skulled, were one tenth the size of their body. Yours is one eighth. So they were small skulls, but long. They would have looked like something from a fantasy film to some regard.
Yeah, when you think
That
about even, I was just going to say, even other mammals have got a wider frequency range in terms of hearing and sight than we do. Not just dogs and cats or pets, but you just think of the whole realm of, dolphins and whales, for example. It's absolutely fascinating. Our five senses, in many ways, are so limited. In our current incarnation, anyway.
Book you wrote, Maria, about this last year, I think it came out. When I was reading about how you were describing the physiological state of these people, and you mentioned the fairies there, I kept thinking that what you call the gentry fairies that lived in the mountains up here, that they were a kind of a mystical military race that went to live inside the mountain. And they were taller than regular human beings, and they seemed to have a stature about them. So there's an example again of the folklore possibly hinting again, outside the archaeological evidence, hinting again. Also, some of the megaliths, even if people were shorter back then, getting into them would have been still difficult. If they had a different structure to their bones, like a different spine or something, they would probably be able to get in easier or something like that. The access to them would be more naturalistic or something. So it definitely, I often wonder, are they even a different species? That's when I read your book, that's what I kept thinking. Were they even people? Are they now an extinct species altogether?
Well, what was discovered by he's quite a young chap, Dr. Ian Barnes. He looked at all the ADNA, ancient DNA samples from the Bronze Age to the back to through the Neolithic, and he came up with a really interesting concept. They don't call them long skulled. I call the Neolithic long skulled, and the Bronze Age had round skulls. Both of them extended their roundness and their length through cranial deformation, but they were natural to begin with. And what Dr. Ian Barnes came out with was that when the very tall Bronze Age people came over to the southern England, for example, they did not mix with the long-skulled people for 500 years, he calculated, and he estimates it must have been that length of time. And then there was a tipping point, and then they started to intermarry. But by a couple of hundred years, going into like 2400 BC, that the Neolithic ADNA had been eradicated. And that's incredible to think that you've got two different cultures, maybe two different types of human beings, and they're not interacting in any way. And I think that explains how some ancient sites were decommissioned, for example, on particular timelines. But I like you pointing out, Thomas, I got really inspired by the folklore of the Fae descending into the mounds. That was part of, and these long-skulled people with their strange ear placement, that could have been like the Fae or the Pixie, descended into the mounds. So you're right, it's about really looking and exploring these tales because they do have an element of truth.
A few years ago, I was in Bucksport, Maine. It's to basically visit a site where the red paint people had been. And the red paint people appear all over Europe, but they also appear in North America from the Neolithic period. So somehow they got across the Atlantic, and they found the traces of their culture in Bucksport in Maine, and also in parts of New Brunswick and Canada. And apparently the Native Americans, and this is one that you could probably want to, you might want to look into, I have been told, though I have not read it anywhere, that the red paint people, mythology, folklore among the natives, the First Nations people in New Brunswick, is that they were taller and had long heads. Now, I thought that's something you could probably pursue, but there is again, the folklore is so enduring.
Absolutely.
Well, that also speaks to potentially we're talking about ancient history and prehistory, and the idea that despite us seeing commonalities around the world, that apparently we're told that there was no global movement, no seafaring culture, that nobody reached North America as it is now until a certain time, and the Far East, all these things were all isolated and completely separate. And even though just seeing one common trait in one species, human or otherwise, in one side of the world, one another, doesn't mean that they somehow were in communication or interbred or anything. It's certainly suggestive that that was a possibility. Either that, or not in terms of biology now, but in terms of, say, for example, culture and that the outer manifestations of that in terms of construction, that people who, if they were isolated, were having the same ideas, the same concepts, the same spiritual, urges were welling up within them at the same time, or roughly the same. They were doing the same things, a bit like the 100th monkey type idea, And that's not uncommon, because if we take that then into the idea in parapsychology, there's all sorts of things that occur between and within human beings that can't be accounted for in any kind of materialistic science. If you see what I mean, like for example, thinking about someone and then the phone rings and it's them, that type of thing. So that those parapsychological forces are not bound in any ways. Space and time are irrelevant. to those. So these sorts of forces can move through what's perceived as time and space without being bound by any of the rules of that. So I don't know if that actually makes sense. It makes sense to me. I know what I'm trying to say.
Absolutely, and I do sympathise with that, and I do agree with that because it's long been said, the ancient sites have like an energy field, and the veil is thinner, so that you can kind of communicate to different levels, different dimensions to the ancestors. And I know I have communicated to the ancestors there. Like I said, you know, when I found that long-headed Neolithic queen, because she was buried in a prestigious burial, she was high status. You do feel a connection to the past. You do feel that things are possible, that, you know, magic is afoot when you're at these ancient sites and people come together. So there is that side to it as well. The veil is thin at these places.
The Rollright stones that you were talking there about, the energy, the New Scientist magazine in 1982 covered it very seriously, I might add, the this kind of diamagnetic effect between stones that went to the center of the circle and kind of spiraled into a different reality. It just vanished. There was also Philip S. Callahan, and he, the American military engineer, went around Ireland in the 1940s, bringing all this like high-tech equipment to the ancient sites, and he confirmed absolutely that they were able to do. There was something, there was paramagnetic and diamagnetic energy being harvested by the sites from the sun, that they were actually going into the crystalline structure of the rocks. Now, an American military scientist, and not like a hippie or something like this. So this information has been around a very long time, approached in different ways. But there's no doubt about it that there's that, you know, I often wonder that these mysterious lost civilizations who built these megaliths, did they future-proof something into them that would make them happen, make things happen now? You know, they often, there's always a feeling I get. You said Rollright. Rollright has this, it almost feels like, you know, those Russian nested dolls, like we're only seeing the outside doll. You have to take that one off, and then we'll see the other dolls inside. It has that feel, you know. Rollright is one of those circles you're going, ah, come on now. There's a lot more going on here than a few stones in a field and some folklore. And some of them do have that, like, come on, come and look closer, have a look. They beckon you into marveling at them in a different way. There's definitely a seductive quality to many of these megalithic sites.
Well, what you were saying, Maria, about connection to the past and that in, now in the present and carrying that forward into the future, maybe for both of you, that would be a positive way to think about, you know, drawing the conversation to a close, thinking about where we are now and where we're going, and that connection to the past that is so important. And that's what it seems the attempt is, to sever us from that. And for me, the trends in technology, as I mentioned earlier, the transhumanist and technocratic, and, you know, digitizing everything and moving away from the physical and the biological, is in some level could be the ultimate negation of that literal physical past. You know, just trying to cut that off for once and for all, so that we're living in some kind of virtual world where, outside of that, in a bit like in Logan's Run or something, you know, these science fiction dystopias, there's the world within the dome, which is where they would want us to end up, and then there's the natural world, the debris of that lying outside, and we would have no access, or our descendants perhaps would have no access to that, thinking the world inside the dome is all there is.
Yes, well, one thing I did in my research to kind of bring the past to the present and to the future to wrap up, so to speak, is that I started to look into what did the people not only look like, I've described that in a nutshell, but what were they wearing? How did they present themselves in ritual? And what I discovered was, for example, in the Bronze Age, that's the height of Stonehenge fame, if you will, they wore very finely woven, almost silk type of material that was obtained through the white nettle on the fens. And when it was looked at through a microscope, it was more finer than the fabrics that I'm wearing today. The also some artifacts were reanalyzed, and it was noticed, for example, that there was these beautiful pieces of jet that had skin on them. They were spacers for ears. Then they found piercings just here that they and also pierced earrings. Then awls that they used to think was to punch leather that was now again re-looked at, and they were used for tattoos. So now you have a priesthood at Stonehenge that was highly tattooed, wore jet spacers, had a lot of piercings and a lot of tattoos. When I was writing about this for my book, my daughter Raven turned around and said, "Mum, that sounds like me and my friends." Yeah, it's almost like it's kind of come full circle, maybe even reincarnated, for example. So I see that how the ancient fashion was for the high priest and the priestly are being played out in Gen Z today. So I think that the elements of the past never left. They never left the ancient sites. They're still there, and people tap into them. And so I think that the past is closer than what we think.
I have been diving very deeply into late Victorian, early 20th century sort of weird fiction, not just Lovecraft, where there are numerous mentions of megaliths in the stories, but also the work of people like Angelon Blackwood, Algernon Blackwood, sorry, and Walter Machen. And the sort of mythologizing of these, again, the other an ancient place, usually with some history, that transports people to a sublime, psychedelic, almost other realm, as if these ancient sites are portals. Now, this was very prevalent in the turn of the last century, and I've recently just been reading this remarkable book by The House on the Borderlines by William Hoskins, and it's about basically someone who goes to an ancient part of our and vanishes into another reality. So there's always it's always existed. I'm now like looking in terms of bringing that into the modern world. This, kind of like creating kind of a literary revival around, a sort of a post, Nigel Neale, Colin Wilson, new literary aspect. I'm not good enough, but I'd like to encourage people who are, or even to start writing short stories, that we now take our part in mythologizing the ancient sites along and linking it to things like cosmology and stuff like that, and all kinds of other things, the quantum world, whatever you want, for the people going forward, in the same way we have the weird fiction in the past. And I find that I get tremendous a tremendous emotional and psychological insights by applying that stuff, that kind of weird fiction to de and I'm not the only one. Colin Wilson did it. And John Michael Greer definitely kind of does it in his own kind of work. So there seems to be have been a kind of a an emerging there of this kind of stuff. So that's where I feel I feel like I want to kind of like dissipate into the mythology of a new mythology of a new aesthetic regarding ancient sites. As we're going forward from this point on.
Well, I feel that our species will abide beyond the transient kind of temporary schemes and plans of the technocrats and transhumanists. We're just not quite sure what that looks like at the moment. I hope for viewers and listeners, there'll be an audio version of this as well, that there's a bit of food for thought here for anyone, whatever generation you're from, whatever experience you have in these areas going forward. And how we preserve our essential humanity in the face of what has sometimes seemed like insurmountable odds. But just look at what those who came before us, what they faced, and what they prevailed through. So we'll do this not only because we want to, because we have to. So before we sign off, Thomas and Maria, why don't you share with viewers details of where they can find you online, and just any, closing things you'd like to add.
Well, I you can I have two films coming out that I didn't make. I'm in them. One of them is called The Fae Folk, and that's probably going to come out at Christmas or just after Christmas. I don't know if it's going on Netflix or Amazon Prime, but it's an American production company. And it basically, I took them to my part in the film was to take them to ancient sites around Ireland. So there's quite a good, some good film, great footage of megaliths in that, and also discussions of folklore. I'm also in the early stages of working on another film, an Irish production company, that it called Moss Upon Stones. And it basically, I'll be outlining a theory regarding an enormous alignment I found that I'm amazed that no one has discovered it yet. I'm not telling anybody it's mine until the film. Maybe someone did years ago find it. I don't know about it. But that's coming out. That'll be coming out in the new year. And I'm doing a talk in Ledbury in England in the middle of December with John Waters. Apparently, it's on, and I'll be talking. Well, I won't be talking about that subject, but this subject. But I'll be talking about like social engineering and mind control, and how to transcend that. So I suppose, I guess in a way, it does connect with this. And so that's Thomas Sheridan on Substack, and also on YouTube, my Beyond Room 313 channel is the one that has all the documentaries and films pertinent to what we've been discussing.
Yeah, like Thomas, I'm going to be on a film. I'm on a film at the moment on Amazon, Code 12, and I'm going to feature in the sequel where we're looking at DNA and influences of megalithic sites. I've got my own film out on Amazon, and that's The Secret History of Stonehenge. So please have a look into that. I really dive deeply into Stonehenge and many other sites. Currently, I'm working on a book on ancient Egypt, and I'll be leading a tour to Egypt in November next year. It's going to be very affordable for people, so keep an eye out on my website, which is theavebury-experience.co.uk. You can find out more about me and my courses on esotericcollege.com, and I've got lots of talks and outings coming up pretty soon, and my website is about to be updated, and I'll be in Mexico the 1st to the 8th as well, and details of that are also on my website, theavebryexperience.co.uk.
Wonderful. Well, Thomas and Maria, thank you so much once again for joining us tonight on legalizefreedom.com.